From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in April when President Trump threatened to block a loan to the Postal Service. He called it a joke. And as author and historian Richard John pointed out in the Washington Post, the president seemed to contradict himself. He demanded that the post office raise package prices dramatically and then promised that he would never let our post office fail. As John notes, the post office was never designed to operate like a business. It was designed as a civic good, a way to connect all citizens, a national service. That mission could never really be sustained without the government absorbing some of the cost. Do you think FedEx or UPS wants to deliver to rural Wyoming? But now the president is saying that the post office cannot be trusted, and mail-in voting is not reliable. He wants everyone to vote in person during a pandemic in which standing in close quarters is a good way to risk your life. Well, this hour, we examine the history and the mission of the Postal Service. We'll explore how it can change to meet the modern age and the role it can play during a pandemic. We reached out to a lot of different people, historians, authors, journalists. We reached out to mail carriers and those in the Postal Service. Heard back from a number of them. Individual letter carriers have largely been told not to talk to us. We understand that. I did not reach out to the head of the Postal Service, Mr. DeJoy himself. He's been a little busy. Perhaps he would come on this program in the future. But just know that that's what we've been trying to do, is try to reach out as far and wide as we can to get perspective on history, to understand the historic background of the Postal Service, and also to connect it to the current moment here. I mean, we're talking about, yes, sending letters to one another, but we're also talking about voting in a pandemic, what can be trusted and what cannot, how we operate during a time that is unprecedented. So let's welcome our guests now. As I mentioned, the author of that piece in the Washington Post is a professor of history and communications at Columbia University and the author of Spreading the News, The American Postal System from Franklin to Morse. Professor Richard John is with us. Richard, thanks for making the time.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
James O'Rourke is with us, a teaching professor of management and organization at the University of Notre Dame's Mendoza School of Business. Professor, thank you for being with us.
Happy to be here. Thanks for the privilege.
You got it. Kenny Montgomery is president of Branch 210 of the National Association of Letter Carriers. Kenny, welcome. Thanks for making time for us.
No, my pleasure. It's good to talk to you guys today.
And Tiana Magnon is with us, a freelance journalist and the owner of Magnon Media Management. Tiana, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know, we had talked to Tiana about doing a conversation about sort of the tumult surrounding USPS. And I know it's something that you were working on. And so why don't you give us a little bit of background about what you were digging into? Because I confess, what we're going to hear from our guest this hour, Tiana, is a history that I probably could have made certain assumptions, but I don't know that most people know the history of the USPS.
Yeah, I think when you think of the USPS, you really just think of mailing letters, like you mentioned earlier. And when I really started to look into it, especially the cuts over the few decades and really just the history of it, it's actually a lot more interesting than I thought. So this article that I originally was thinking, you know, maybe 600, 800 words for, it just spiraled out of control. And so I'm glad that I was able to reach out to you and Megan for help.
how much do you feel, Tiana, that the American public is getting an accurate picture of what the mission of the USPS is versus, you know, some of the rhetoric that we're hearing?
You know, it's really just not clear to me. And, you know, this is something I've actually been interested in for a while. And yet, almost every time I even visit just the USPS website, I'm learning something new. So I'm not sure. Maybe, you know, the rhetoric actually trying to be negative to kind of downplay what the USPS is doing. But the vast majority of Americans have no idea the real kind of work that the USPS is doing day in and day out.
Well, let me start with Professor John, who I quoted in the Washington Post piece. You know, Professor, when we hear the president and his acolytes talking about the current state of affairs with the USPS, you know, I think it would be easy for Americans to stop and think, well, hey, if it's losing money, if it's not, if half of it is junk mail, then why are we even doing it? Without understanding what the mission was and whether it was set up to be run like a business at all. Can you give us some of the history that you think is pertinent here?
Well, I think we need to begin with the generation of the founders. 1792, lawmakers invested the post office, which is in the federal constitution, with a civic mandate to circulate information on public affairs. At that time, public affairs were primarily covered in newspapers. So you had low-cost circulation of newspapers. Even more important for our own moment, as we don't get our news in newspapers anymore, for the most part, sent through, certainly not sent through the mail, Congress also retained control over the designation of new routes. That is to say, the extension of the postal network from the seaboard into the hinterland would not be controlled by the Postmaster General, would not be controlled by the executive, but instead be controlled by Congress, legislative branch, the branch that was closest to the American people. And that mandate meant that it was going to be very hard for the organization to cover its costs on all routes because many of the routes didn't pay one-hundredth of the expense. But it also meant that Congress is the ultimate arbiter of the character of this remarkable institution.
Do you have any affinity for the argument that, okay, well, that was in the late 1700s, but in 2020 it ought to be run like a business, Professor Jones?
Well, here's what happened. Much of our history from 1792 up to 1970, the presumption was that the post office is a service. And that meant that it was different qualitatively from a business. And the lawmakers repeatedly affirmed that fact. It's a service. That is to say, it's not supposed to make money. In fact, the post office had more revenue than more cost than revenue, more expense than income between 1851 and 1970 in most years. 1970, establishment of U.S. Postal Service, the primary goal was to get the post office out of politics. Post office had been a major source of patronage, whatever party was in power. Contracts were often politicized. It's no longer going to be a line item in the federal budget. Congress will pay separately for whatever services are not going to cover the cost, and Postmaster General will not be picked by the president, but instead will be picked by the Board of Governors, a new entity that had the responsibility to oversee it, the post office. So it's a business-government hybrid, as the historian Winifred Gallagher put it, and that's what it's been ever since. So it is not a line item in the federal budget, and until 2006, that worked pretty well. It was making money. At that point, Congress settled it with some additional obligations, in retrospect regarded widely as unfortunate. And then, of course, we have Internet, COVID-19.
Professor O'Rourke, I'm going to try to put my business student hat on, and you can grade my either assumptions or my ideas here. But if we were to create a USPS from scratch today and we tell it, well, you know, right now nobody gets mail. It's a great idea to deliver mail, but you're gonna have to run it like a business. My guess is, as I said at the outset, that business would deliver in big metropolitan areas, more densely populated spaces, and the folks in rural Wyoming, Montana, maybe even rural New York State, they really, you know, they might be left out here. I mean, I'm not sure that's a profitable model to go all those extra miles in sparse population. And that's why, at least from my very limited understanding of history, it was not necessarily designed just to operate like a business. Is that wrong, Professor O'Rourke?
No, I would say that's approximately right. And let me say thank you to my colleague from Columbia for a wonderful, accurate and to the point description of the postal system in this country. Moving the post office off the U.S. books, if you will, in 1970 was part of a political movement among neoconservatives. And while I am not a political scientist, I think you have to understand this in order to know how we got to where we are today. The so-called neocon movement of the late 20th century admired much of the work of Margaret Thatcher in the UK and others who sought to privatize portions of government that these political theorists didn't want the government to perform. I think Grover Norquist once famously said, "I don't want no government. I want a government small enough I can drown in the bathtub." But clearly, while there are some services that are quite close to the private sector, it remains true that only they can provide those services. And that would be the National Weather Service, the National Park Service, the U.S. Forest Service, and, of course, the U.S. Postal Service. Now, if I were to walk in and accept that blank challenge to deliver mail, packages and letters and other classes of mail, I would have a couple of choices. The obvious choice would be don't go where there isn't any money. If you look at the airline business, there are airlines in this company, or in this country rather, that make money flying only to profitable locations. They don't go to those other locations. Mm-hmm. I was born and raised in the Yellowstone Valley of Montana, and we had a nice airport in Billings, but you didn't have to go terribly far in Montana to find no air service of any kind. And if you live up on the High Line in Glasgow, Havre, Wolf Point, there are airports up there. There just is no service. And there is a national, subsidized by the Congress, emergency air service that will fly you to Billings or will fly you to Minneapolis or somewhere like that. But it's clearly not profitable. Someone has to subsidize it. So that's one model. The other model is to overcharge those portions of your revenue stream that are most profitable. That's ironically what the President of the United States suggested. He suggested raising rates by four times. A first-class stamp is 49 cents. A $4 stamp is no bargain if you're looking at a commodity. So it's anybody, any student who has studied pricing theory knows that in a commodity market, if you raise your prices continuously, that curve shows a downward decline in the number of purchases. So in so many ways, if you're really going to serve everyone, you have to acknowledge that it's probably not going to break even. Businesses have already rolled in the cost not only of postage, but of private package delivery services. Comparison shop. Take that 11 by 14 envelope with 12, 14 ounces in it to the post office, $1.85, give or take, depending on what the zone is. You go over to the UPS or FedEx operation, and the opening bid is likely to be something around $19. Again, business has rolled that into the budget. They know it's something they have to budget for. The upper class hand it to their people, and they go take care of it, and they never know what it costs. The upper middle class pay for it and say, well, I mean, that's just how things are. The lower middle class wince and say, ouch, but, you know, we don't have a choice. Those people in the working class, among the working poor, simply say, I can't afford it. I can't send anything through private package delivery services. So the solutions are relatively simple. I'm happy to talk about those. But we got here because a political movement wanted to reduce the size of government and reduce the cost of government. But it remains absolutely true that there are some things that only government can perform.
Well, and we will certainly talk about solutions coming up here. Just one brief follow-up, Professor O'Rourke. Is it accurate to surmise that if the Postal Service went away, that the or at least if it went to a full sort of, as the president has said, a business model that can be sustained on its own, that the parts of the country that would lose service are mostly red states or red areas, it seems to me.
Well, that's ironic, isn't it?
But is that right?
Well, I think a portion of that is certainly correct. There are other services, though, that are evenly distributed across the nation. I'm a retired United States Air Force officer. I receive my medications from Express Scripts in my mailbox. I didn't get a vote on that. That's what the Department of Defense told me the arrangement would be. I can pick up the phone and talk to a pharmacist. Now, of course, as a college professor, I can afford to go over to Walgreens or CVS and buy those medications, but a lot of people can't. A lot of people depend on them, and a lot of vets who have service-connected disabilities are taking some really expensive pharmaceuticals, and this is life and death stuff for them. So it's not a matter of my missing my copy of The Economist this week. It is a matter of a lot of people being heavily dependent on those kinds of distribution systems.
Listeners, as we go throughout this hour talking about the history of the United States Postal Service, its current challenges, how it should operate during a pandemic, and what solutions may be within reach going forward, you can call the program toll-free. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI for calling from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email us, connections@WXXI.org. And I want to turn to Tiana and Kenny. And, you know, Tiana, there's two things that come to mind for me right off the top here. First of all, when we talk about a lack of equity in sort of utilities and access to internet, for example, some of the critics, kind of the armchair critics of the post office would say, look, people don't use it anymore. It's not sustainable. It's a bad business model. And people can use digital services. But we don't have equality. We don't have equity. We don't have digital access across this country in any sense that would make that, at least from what I can glean, feasible. And when we also talk about, you know, who is employed by the post office, who are they, who they are serving, and who they employ, their employment record is of marginalized populations as well. So those are some of the things that come to mind for me, and I wonder if you can elaborate on those.
Yeah, I definitely want to jump on that a little bit. The post office really does hire way higher rates of people of color, women, veterans. So a lot of people who are disproportionately kind of left out of the workforce, not only do they find jobs, you know, with USPS, but really great high benefit jobs. But I think it is important to note that these armchair critics who say that the post office is really slow, they're right. We can't ignore that. I think having this conversation really requires that we talk about the 20-minute, 30-minute long wait that sometimes happens at different post offices. There's actually a 5-year plan on the USPS website that you can check out. It's super vague, but this idea of modernizing the post office is such a big part of it because for most people, it really feels like you're stepping back in the 1970s. You have to wait in line to send a money order, get stamps, just very small things like that. And so really just streamlining it so that people don't feel like they're dealing with this bureaucracy every time they step in the USPS is not only important for the USPS, but also how we kind of view it as a system.
Well, I want to get the perspective of Kenny Montgomery, the president of Branch 210 of the National Association of Letter Carriers, for your perspective on the current state of affairs and the debate about, you know, I think, Kenny, let's start even before pandemic, because in a moment we really need to focus on what happens this year. We are in an urgent situation here where people need options to vote. We're going to get there in a moment here, but how do you see the state of business, of success or challenge of the USPS? How do you see the landscape, Kenny?
Well, geez, I got a lot to address here, I think. And certainly your other panelists here are excellent advisors because everything they've said so far, I've agreed with 100%. But I would offer this, Evan. We already have a glimpse of what that would look like of operating on a business-type atmosphere. UPS, FedEx, Amazon, these are delivery companies. And when they get a package that is in a rural area that it's not cost effective for them to ship, they drop it off at the post office. every day. We have Amazon and UPS and FedEx trucks that back up to our docks to drop off packages that is not profitable for them to ship. So they give them to us. If they had to take them there themselves, they would have to charge an additional fee to do that. So we're already in that situation where if we were to operate more like a business, we wouldn't be able to do that.
Okay. What do you make of the president, yes, but also his supporters and some conservatives higher up in government talking about dramatically changing the post office, cutting the funding of it, and trying to treat it more like the business model that you just described that looks, at least from the outside, is kind of unsustainable. What do you make of all that, Kenny?
To be completely blunt and honest with you, and I know there's going to be some out there that are going to hear what I have to say and not agree with it, but it's a fact. We are sustainable. We are sustainable if the government would leave us alone. And that's really what it comes down to. In 2006, one of the panelists earlier mentioned 2006. 2006, the government passed a law that said we are mandated to pre-fund our health benefits for retirees for 75 years. Now, just give you a little perspective on that. If a baby is born 15 years from today, grows to be 20 years old, that's 35 years, works for the Postal Service for 40 years, and retires, we have to pay for that child's health benefits as a retiree. We have to pay that today. That's somebody who's not even born for another 15 years. It costs the Postal Service $5.6 billion a year that we have to give the government for these future benefits.
Does that make sense to you?
We already have $50 billion in the bank, but we're not allowed to touch it until that fund is fully funded, which is close to $100 billion. It makes no sense. And I would just add, if they took away that obligation, we're profitable. We're making money.
Kenny,
we made over $1 billion last year operationally without that one mandate.
Kenny, the first email I got was from Paul, who said, what business funds its retirement 75 years into the future? That would sink any business. The post office should stay as a government service. That's from Paul. Okay. Is there political will to make a change in the way that you're describing there, Kenny?
There actually is. There's a lot of support in the House and Senate. We've talked to a lot of congressmen who are questioning, why was this bill ever done? And to that answer, I don't know. We can only guess that it was somebody's desire back in 2006 to break the Postal Service and privatize it, knowing that that kind of a funding level would break us. But I would say that in 2006, we were at our peak level. People were using the Postal Service at the time more than anything else. We really hadn't hit that big internet boom yet. We hadn't hit the economy breakdown that we had in 2008, 2007. So when all that stuff hit, well, this law is already on the books, and we're now mandated to make these payments every year. So when you hear the Postal Service post, for example, a $4 billion loss last year, well, that includes a $5.6 billion payment to the government. So take away that $5.6 billion payment, we made $1.6 billion in profit, which we're not even supposed to do. But operationally, we would have turned a profit that year.
Professor O'Rourke, can you evaluate those claims?
Yes, thanks for that. The 2006 law that our friend is talking about was the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act, introduced by Senator Susan Collins of Maine. That became law and required the post office to pay retirement health care benefits for workers 75 years into the future. Now, there are a few other agencies within the federal government that have a requirement to pre-fund, but nothing even approaching that level. And this year's payment is likely in September to be around $6.9 billion. Senator Collins is a very astute politician, and she has never spoken publicly on this particular topic. My calls to her office have gone unreturned. One of the things you should understand about that 2006 mandate, however, is that it expired in 2017. So for the last 2.5 years, presumably the post office could do what it wants and quit funding that trust fund, but the post office has continued to pay into it at the same level. And that trust fund is pretty substantial right now. It's my calculations, and this is not totally transparent on postal service documents, but it's around $40 billion. The relatively simple fix here, you don't have to repeal that law. It expired. The relatively simple fix, and maybe the letter carriers will not agree with me, but hear me out. I think the Congress of the United States has to permit postal workers and letter carriers to join Medicare at age 65. Again, I'm a retired military officer. I didn't get a choice. That was what I was told. I could no longer go into a military hospital. I had to use Medicare. I'm fine with that. By the way, it's not free. I pay for it. I pay for my wife's account, and I have paid into it for the last 50 years as part of my paycheck. That's a deduction. Medicare works very nicely, but it requires the recipient to participate. The same is true of a 401k or a 503b individual retirement account. Those are manageable, and I would tell you without question, the day of a defined benefit pension or a defined benefit health care system is gone. General Motors went over and handed their retirement health care plan to the United Auto Workers and said, here's $3.8 billion. We cannot run this health care program and stay in business. It's unsustainable. Everybody in the private sector has gotten out of that business, and it's time, in my judgment, for the Postal Service to move its retirees to Medicare when appropriate. So that's certainly the easiest simple step, but I would add this. The House of Representatives did what it was supposed to do last week. Speaker Pelosi gathered a bill together to provide a short-term rescue package. She got a bipartisan group of members to vote for it, 100% of Democrats, 26 Republicans. The bill passed easily. She walked it down the hallway to the Senate office building, and she put it in Leader McConnell's desk. And Leader McConnell said he had no intention of sending it to committee for hearing or to put it to the floor for an up or down vote. That bill will die in Leader McConnell's in-basket. So my customary advice is write to your congressman, but I don't think that's going to do anything at this point. I quite honestly think that the current circumstance serves the political interest of the administration, and the interest really is sowing doubt, fear, and confusion. One of the things Louis DeJoy said that I totally agree with in his testimony to the House Oversight Administration Committee is that the Postal Service can adequately handle all of those ballots. There's no doubt in his mind. There's no doubt in my mind. Look at the numbers from a year ago. The Postal Service handled 1.2 billion pieces in November, in 1 month. That's the run-up to Christmas. In October of this year, you don't quite have a run-up to Christmas yet, and if you add 15 to 18 million ballots to that, can the Postal Service do it? Yes, they can. Day at the beach for those guys.
Can I ask Kenny Montgomery if you agree with that?
I'm chomping at the bit to weigh in on this, Mr. O'Rourke. I agree with everything you've just said. Your assertion that we would be against the Medicare integration nationally, our union has taken a stance. We agree with Medicare integration, but it has to be done intelligently. In other words, we've got a lot of our retirees in their 80s and even 90s who don't have Medicare. And if they were required to all of a sudden get Medicare, the rules of Medicare, they would be penalized 10% for every year they didn't get it. I mean, it would cost them an inordinate amount of money. So they would have to be grandfathered in, and the penalty would have to be waived. But we are absolutely agreeing with the Medicare integration. As far as the ballots, I can tell you this. On an average day, the Postal Service handles 470 million pieces of mail on one day. Last presidential election, 128 million people voted. 62 million voted for Donald Trump and 65 million voted for Hillary Clinton. We're not even going to discuss who got more votes. But 128 million people voted. That's about a quarter of a single day's volume. To somehow say we would not be able to handle that kind of volume is crazy. That's an average day for us. That's nothing. We have 160 million addresses across this country. Any given week, we have our different mailings. We have our Red Plum advertisers. We have the Valpak advertisers. These are house-to-house advertisers that come out every week. So we're delivering to every single address every day.
Okay.
Say we couldn't handle one more piece of mail for these houses? That's crazy.
Okay, so but there's a couple of other, I think, criticisms from the president. And let me ask Professor John and frankly, I'd like all of our guests to help us understand this. And I'm just going to be blunt about this.
Evan, can I add one more thing?
Yeah, please.
I didn't want to lose this point.
On the
pre-funding of our health benefits. I had a conversation with Congressman Collins. Now, we all know he had his own legal problems, but I had a conversation with him last spring about the pre-funding. And he used to be the county executive in Buffalo. And he tried to get the Buffalo County employees to pre-fund their health benefits. And New York State told him, that's illegal. We can't do that. So in New York State, it's illegal to do what the federal government is forcing the Postal Service to do.
Okay.
So I want to make that point. So.
Okay. Now, on the subject of the election here.
Yes.
Kenny is just as Professor O'Rourke points out, is talking about the volume that mail carriers handle every day in this country and how many millions of people might vote by mail, why that would be called into question as a viable option. I don't like to try to psychoanalyze, but I'd like our guests to help us understand what this is actually about. Professor John, we are in the middle of a national emergency. We have one of the highest rates of deaths per million of anybody in the world now. And it has been an international embarrassment to see that it has gone on the way it has. But we have to be able to vote. And I selfishly, I've said on this program many times, I think about my parents. I think about my mother, who was hospitalized 3 times last winter for pneumonia. I don't want her voting in person. I want her to have options. I don't want her waiting in line. I don't want her standing inside. And I don't understand the idea that we can't do this by mail and therefore let's give up on it. Or I guess what I'm saying, Professor John, is if there were a legitimate problem with voting by mail, shouldn't we have the kind of leadership that seeks to fix that and still make that an option as opposed to just saying don't vote by mail? I mean, it seeks to invalidate everything. I don't understand what this is about other than trying to undermine the validity of the election. And we have got to have options for people. What do you see this as being about, Professor John?
Well, the current president has said the quiet part out loud. He has stated in numbers of Americans vote November. He will not win re-election and the Republican Party will be destroyed. So he has said that publicly, which is very customarily that kind of statement, though party operatives are well aware that in certain circumstances you want to depress voter turnout and boost voter turnout. President Trump has also stated, very surprisingly, that though he opposes vote by mail in Nevada, he favors vote by mail in Florida. These are unsustainable claims from any logical point of view. Quick overview of voting by mail. Civil War soldiers voted by mail. Military has an entire division of the Pentagon support voting by mail. In Oregon, they voted by mail. So this is not a logical proposition that has much merit. It is an attempt to undermine the legitimacy of the election. It's an attempt perhaps to sow fear in the minds of certain Americans who might be wary of voting by mail, but who do not want to go to the polls, as you yourself described. And it is a way to undermine the legitimacy of an organization that employs over 500,000 men and women who've been providing a vital service for well over 2 centuries. It is an extraordinarily bizarre claim for a president to make. I've been scratching my head. I've done a couple pieces on presidents and the post office. And no previous president has attacked the post office, calling it a joke. It's like mother. It's like apple pie, motherhood. President after president has praised, quite rightly, the men and women who work for the Postal Service and the extraordinary job that they do. So I think it's inspired by fear. I think it's an effort to bamboozle the American public and to undermine our experiment in self-government. The founders would have been outraged. We should be, too.
Professor O'Rourke, your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree completely with my colleague. I think that's an accurate assessment. I began paying attention to the Postal Service about 15 years ago, just out of curiosity. And the phrase that came to mind is that you cannot run a democracy without a decent postal service. I said to a colleague in the hallway the other day, if the Postal Service collapses and they lock the front door next August, we'll look like a third world nation. And he looked right at me and said, Jim, third world nations have really good postal services. I told an interviewer for the Washington Post and for the New York Times about a week and a half ago, that for the 15 years I've been looking at the annual reports, at the cost structure, at cash flow within the Postal Service, I have tried really hard to be objective, neutral, and fair about this. I would simply say, well, here are the figures, draw your own conclusions. I left that position about 10 days ago. This is no longer a sustainable issue. It's clear to me that the president has given instruction to Secretary Mnuchin in the Department of the Treasury. He's offered a loan to the Postal Service, but the conditions of the loan are that if they take it, that operational control of the Postal Service reverts to the Secretary of the Treasury. There is no argument in favor of what the president is doing, because the movements taken by Postmaster General DeJoy are not even capable of closing the gap on the deficit, and what they're doing simply is sowing doubt, creating fear, stirring confusion, and I think that serves the president's purpose. As I've watched the administration over the last 3.5 years, I see that he needs an enemy at almost every turn. And this week, it's the U.S. Postal Service, and I think it will remain so until November. And then if reelected, he'll move on to someone else. If not reelected, then it's up to the Democrats to clean this up. But I don't see a business argument for anything he's done. Let me just give you a really quick example. If you look at the annual reports of the Postal Service, you will see that overtime moved from 10% of operating costs to 13% of operating costs between 2018 and 2019. Most folks would look at that line and just move on. I saw a 3% jump in overtime, and the first thing I thought to myself is, why would they do that? Well, the answer is always it's cheaper to provide overtime to pay time and a half to a worker than it is to hire a new worker. Then I began looking at the number of retirees who were not replaced. That's a significant number. The Postal Service is doing what I think is heroic work these days with fewer people than they actually are authorized to have. I can only conclude that the Postal Service and postmasters around the country are using the pay they would have given people who aren't being hired on in order to cover operational costs, or they've been told not to replace them. And you can draw your own conclusion on that, but that's not a sensible business decision. You've got to keep a steady stream of newly trained workers, and it's not like we have a shortage of unemployed people these days. That figure's around 17 million. So there's none of this makes any business sense.
Well, so let me, before I get to your phone calls, if you're there, we're going to squeeze in as much listener comment in our last 15 minutes as we can. But I want to ask Tiana Mignon, to kind of respond to something Professor O'Rourke just said, which kind of sticks in my mind as a journalist. You know, he talked about, Tiana, the desire to kind of view this from a neutral lens, but then coming to a conclusion that feels inescapable. And I would even build on what Professor O'Rourke said in that the only thing that is logical to me, the only reason you convince people during a pandemic in which people could die if they vote in person, that you must go risk your life and vote in person, is because if you sow enough doubt about an election, that gives you grounds, if you lose, to say, well, it was never valid. And he sees the polls, and now all of a sudden you've got the grounds to contest it. But, Tiana, I look at Florida. Florida is a place where you would think older voters would be voting more for the president. I want them to vote by mail if they need to. I want everyone—this is not partisan. And if that means the president wins Florida, he wins Florida. I want people to vote safely everywhere in Florida and Wyoming and Ohio and New York State. But when you see, Tiana, when you see this kind of national debate, journalists try to stay neutral. Believe it or not, they really do. And I wonder, having been a journalist yourself and also kind of a, I would say, a very effective media critic at times, what do you think is a fair way to cover this when it feels like literal lives are at stake? How do you see it, Tiana? All of a sudden, we lost Tiana. Just like that. Oh, there we are. Are you there, Tiana?
Okay, wait. No, I was muted. Okay.
There you go.
So I think it's important to point out that neutrality is probably the most dangerous angle that you can have on this, especially because neutrality tends to kind of skew towards people in power. For the most part, we are really going to trust officials with what they say. And even if you kind of push back, it's a couple graphs down. So I would say the most important way to kind of cover this issue, especially to make it more interesting, is to go that human interest angle. Every story I've seen where they're actually speaking to mail carriers, it is way more relevant. And I think I come away with a lot better of an understanding than kind of the abstract approach to it. I think pretending that this is just a business kind of thing, they're trying to cut the budget or anything like that, it's a really silly approach, just because we know across society there have been so many different efforts to kind of restrict who can vote and how they can vote. So from voter ID laws to trying to restore people who have committed felonies, their rights, there are so many different efforts to kind of control who can vote. I think that we do need to see this as another instance of that, and arguably one of the biggest instances of controlling voting in America in a while. So I think unless journalists take that bigger stance, most of Americans aren't even going to understand that the battle that's waging right now is really going to dictate what politics looks like for the next probably few decades. Mm.
Well, let me work in some listener feedback here. Wendy, first up, calling from Rochester. Hi, Wendy, go ahead.
Yes, full disclosure, mail carriers have been my hero since my mail carrier found my cat when I was 8. I just really think that there's an unintended consequence of having mail carriers, and therefore we do not value it. It is contributing to the public safety of our communities to have a person who comes through every week, knows who hasn't picked up their mail, who is elderly, notices if somebody is running through a backyard. It builds community. It builds trust. If you don't love your mail carrier, then you must have a really mean mail carrier.
I want Kenny Montgomery to respond to that. Thank you, by the way, there, Wendy. Kenny, go ahead.
You know, Wendy, I thank you, and your letter carrier thanks you, I'm sure. Evan, I want to tell you a couple of quick stories, and I will be very brief. What she says is absolutely true. Having a letter carrier in your neighborhood every day is a potential lifesaver. Every day across this country, letter carriers are saving lives, from a customer who falls and gets hurt to we had a customer in Westgate who his son tried to commit suicide by starting his car in the garage, left a note in the mailbox. The mailman came on, found the note, and got to the garage before the young man had passed away. Recently, back in November, we had a carrier, Ramiki Hill, out of the Beechwood Station, who came upon a police officer who was in a life struggle with a man who was stabbing him. The police officer lost his sight, but our carrier tackled the assailant and saved the police officer's life. This happens every day all across America. And if you take the Postal Service out, it's not going to just take away your postal service. It's going to take away lives.
Tom in Brighton on the phone next. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I'd like to understand how much the postal service is subsidized by the government. That letter that has to be delivered to Wyoming in some remote location, are we subsidizing it to the tune of 10 cents or a dollar or $10? That makes a big difference as to, you know, what we're talking about.
Okay, Tom, thank you. Professor O'Rourke, do you know the answer to that?
Well, I don't have an exact figure for you. You can only deal with collapsed or aggregate figures there. But the one figure you need to know is that the Postal Service makes money on operations. They clear a sum of money each year, which is carried as retained earnings. Those retained earnings, interesting side note here, are required by federal law to be invested in U.S. Treasury notes, which are now bearing about a quarter of a percent interest. So, you know, if that money is left in that account in 10 years, you're lucky you get any of it back. So the Postal Service makes money on the packages and letters it carries. The problem with the Postal Service, as with every other private enterprise, are what are called off-book costs. And you're looking at retirement, pensions, you're looking at health care, you're looking at modernizing and upgrading the service. Nobody says they don't have to be efficient. They do. But they've got a scheme to make it work and to clear a profit each year.
All right.
Evan, if I could add in.
Go ahead, Kenny, please.
I think there's some confusion on the subsidies the caller is referring to. The subsidy isn't from tax dollars. That subsidy is from, you know, if I turn a profit on this package, that profit turned on this package is then going to go to subsidize another service. So it's not any tax dollars that you're not subsidizing it with your tax money. It's being subsidized by other services that we're selling.
All right. Tom, thank you for the phone call. Let me get Manuel next. Go ahead, Manuel.
Yes.
Are you there, Manuel? Go ahead. Oh, boy, we've got a bad connection, Manuel. I'm sorry about that. I apologize, Manuel. Maybe we can get that connection right before the end of the hour here. Let me get a question from Sharon. She says, has the Postal Service considered stopping Saturday deliveries or one other day of the week to save money and maybe cut down on overtime? Seems like a very reasonable way to save money, and most people do not require delivery every day. That's from Sharon. What do you say to that, Kenny?
It's been considered in the past and flatly rejected by a majority of the public. To say we would cut down on costs, it doesn't work because the mail volume that would be delivered that one day would then have to be spread out amongst the other days, and ended up would be about the same as far as cost wise.
Okay, Professor O'Rourke, any thoughts on Sharon's email there?
Well, that's been looked at very carefully, both by the Postal Service and by people external to the Postal Service. Closing post offices in small towns, eliminating Saturday service, would provide fractional, marginal savings in some cases, and no savings in other cases. And mostly the kinds of things that have been done aren't helping. Removing street corner post boxes, removing fully functional automated letter sorters. I mean, that's not where your money's going. Your money's going to other costs, and the ways to deal with it, I think we've already talked about. So reducing the quality of the service is not an approach that really makes much sense.
All right. Let me, before we end the hour here in our last 2 minutes, Professor John, just maybe a minute or less to kind of close this conversation and keep in mind perspective as this country debates the very future of the USPS during a pandemic. What do you want people to keep in mind?
I want to tell two quick stories, one I heard from a journalist and one I've been thinking about. If you live in a part of the country where you have a taxi at your front door, you can call a taxi or an Uber, then you could probably manage without the facilities that the current Postal Service provides. Awful lot of Americans do not live in places like that. So analogies with Britain, with Japan don't make sense, the economic proposition. But let's talk about the civic mandate of the organization. You moved to Abilene, Kansas. You expect that there's going to be an interstate highway pretty close to you because that interstate highway has always been there. Well, what if some cost-cutting lawmaker says, you know, we don't really need an interstate highway in Kansas anymore. We've got lots of other interstate highways. Maybe we can save some money. Just shut it down. That would be comparable to not providing it with the kind of support it's had in the past. Final point. Biggest fiscal crisis, 1840s. They were losing big money. They would have run out of funds had not Congress stepped in, restructured the contracting, lowered the rates, provided better service, and eliminated the presumption, which is sort of a joke, that the organization was supposed to break even. That's what confronts Congress today, and in the end, that's where the buck will stop. The president, the executive, is not behaving responsibly. It's Congress has a mandate to the American people to keep this extraordinary institution, agent of civilization, up and running for future generations, just as it has in the past.
I want to thank Professors John and O'Rourke for joining us for the hour and lending their expertise and the historical background that we have needed to understand the USPS. Thanks, professors, to both of you.
Thank you.
Kenny Montgomery, the president of Branch 210 of the National Association of Letter Carriers. Thank you for your perspective. And I appreciate it, Kenny. I know it's a busy time, and I hope we can stay in touch on this. Thank you, sir.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for bringing this to light, Evan. I appreciate it.
You got it. Tiana Magnon, you're to blame for all of this. Your outstanding work as a journalist yourself and the outstanding questions you ask. Thanks for sharing the spotlight here, and thanks for joining us as always, Tiana.
Thank you.
More connections coming up next.